Well, it's Mother's Day, so we have to do some things that are traditional and some things that are out of the ordinary and unique so that we don't bore you. I hope we have a good mix of that today. Traditional, we have to talk about World War II. During World War II, Sweden somehow dodged most of the conflict, and people from all over Europe fled to Sweden to get away from the Nazi Holocaust. As they were going, sometimes children would make it, parents wouldn't. So when we come to the end of the war, there are many orphans and street kids all over Sweden. They gathered up all the kids and they put them in what might be called a prison camp, but you know, they weren't prisoners, it was just a place. They put them all in this camp and they had to decide what they were going to do with them. And they said it was the most pathetic thing because these children would go from place to place. Whenever a visitor would come, whenever a guest would come to the camp, they would say, "Who am I? Who are my parents? What's my real name?" And for the most part, nobody knew. Nobody knew the answers. And I just think that's so interesting because that's sort of like the entire human race seems to be going around today saying, "Who am I? You know, what's my real name? What am I really all about? What am I supposed to be?" And mothers are the ones who are the first teachers of those things for most of us kids. Of course, fathers are as well. But there's something special between a mother and her baby. And everybody knows that particularly for the first 18 months, to a lesser extent, for the first 3 years, it's all about mom. And then after about 3 years old, they realize there's also a dad around here. And it really gives us a little bit of an ego boost. But until then, it's all about mom. And the moms are the ones who help us answer the question, who am I? Oh, where do I belong? What am I supposed to be doing? And that is the human question. Today we're looking at one of the favorite passages, I imagine, in all the New Testament for the vast majority of Christians, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, which you heard in your scripture reading. And 1 Corinthians 13, familiar as it is, my clicker's not clicking. I have to use fingers, do it the old-fashioned way. Fingers aren't working either. Nice. Somebody's trying to install new software. Now does the clicker work? Yes, back in business. The text. Just let me do my little running commentary, okay? Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up. This is all a description of love. Love does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not easily provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. But whether there are prophecies, they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. You realize all of this is happening in the context of some nasty things that are going on at the Church of Corinth. The people in Corinth have been bickering. It's ugly, and we're sorry that that's the truth, but that's the truth. And so they were acting like children. Paul says in verse 11, "When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a grown-up, a man, I put away these childish things." But unfortunately, sometimes we don't put away our childish things very well. These are the ages and phases of life, and you expect children to be children, and you expect grown-ups to be grown-ups. And yet, sometimes the Christians act like children, and that's what was happening in Corinth. So the children in Corinth, the grown-ups, were acting like children. They were saying things like, "I'm better than you," which is awful. They didn't say it just that way. Paul says, "It's been declared to me by people who have visited you that there are contentions among you. You're fighting. And this I'm now telling you, that this is what I've heard, that every one of you says, 'I follow Paul.' And another guy says, 'I follow Peter.' And another guy says, 'I'm following Apollos.' And another guy says, 'Well, I'm better than all of y'all because I'm following Christ.' Well, that's just ugly. And so they're saying, 'I'm better than you are.' It's very childish. It's competition. It's show-offishness. It's egocentricity, and all that's happening. They also were saying, in so many words, 'Since I'm amazing in what I can do for Jesus, I don't particularly need you.'" Say, would they really say that? Well, maybe not exactly in those words, But 1 Corinthians 12:21 has Paul describing their problem. He says, so the eye in the body of Christ, you know, which has all these different members, all these different people doing all these different things. The eye can't say to the hand, I have no need of you. Nor again, the head to the feet, I have no need of you. Much more than that, those members of the body which seem to be more feeble are necessary. So the people in Corinth were in the first place saying, I'm better than you because I'm following a better leader. And in the second place, they were saying, I don't really need you because I'm so awesome. And that's just so ugly. And not only that, they were bickering with each other and having such a terrible time. They were threatening to take each other to court. Not just threatening, but actually doing it. So in 1 Corinthians 6:6, but brother goes to law with brother to the court system. And that before unbelievers, because the judges aren't even Christians. Now, therefore, there's utterly a fault among you because you're going to law with one another. Like, why are you doing this? And so you can see this childishness. And the childishness is behind Paul talking about what love is. Like, we can't do this anymore. We can't act like this. And the childishness is also giving birth to this metaphor. When I was a child, I acted like a child. But I don't do that anymore. Now I act like a grown-up. And so it is supposed to be. It's all right for children to act like children. I was reminded this week, and I went back and I watched the video. It's so interesting. Some Yale psychologists were doing experiments with babies, 6 months old and 10 months old. And if you don't remember, 6 months old is very, very young. I mean, they know such a little bit. So they're having these babies watch the show. They bring them into the room, sit on mom's lap. And then they had this, let's call it a puppet stage. You couldn't see the person. You had a little round character with googly eyes. And he was trying to go up a hill. A green hill. It was clearly a hill. And so the lady behind the puppet stage is taking the guy with googly eyes and running him up the side of the hill. And he can't make it. He tries to go up. He can't get up. He tries again. He can't get up. And then they introduce another character. It's a square with googly eyes. It's a blue square. So you have the brown circle with googly eyes. He can't get up the hill. Now, the blue square with googly eyes, when the round character gets stuck halfway up the hill, the square with googly eyes bumps him up, 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 helps him get up to the hill. And they watch that for a while. And then when the round guy with googly eyes gets to the top of the hill, they introduce a new character. It's a triangle with googly eyes. And the triangle pushes him back down the hill. So he tried, he tried, he finally got up the hill, and the triangle comes and pushes him down. And they do this with the kids 6 months old. You know, you don't have a long time to teach this lesson, right? And 10 months old as well. And after the kids have watched that till they're bored, then they change it up. And they tell the mom to close her eyes. She's not allowed to know what's going to happen here. And they bring a tray out to the children. And one of the trays has the triangle guy who pushed him down the hill and the square guy with googly eyes who helped him up the hill. They put him on the tray, and they hold it out to the baby and ask the baby which one he wants to play with. And they almost all the time reject that mean old triangle who pushed that guy down the hill, and they take the blue square who helped him get up the hill. Think, well, what does a six-month-old know? You think that would never work. They said almost every time. Babies, I mean, from the womb just about, they realize who their helpers in life are, and they gravitate to the helpers. Babies have to be self-centered. I mean, their job in life is to learn how to do the next thing, especially learn how to go potty. That's a really big one. Try to learn that as soon as you can. And then when you can dress yourself, that's a red letter day. When you can put your own shoes on, that's a miracle. Go put your shoes on. Wahoo, you know. And eventually they can do so many things. They can walk, they can talk, and it's just wonderful. And that's their job. And in some ways, they keep doing that, you know, through their grade school years and high school years and all that. And you expect it. In a way, you want it to be that way. You don't really want things to be different when you're a baby, when they're that little. Sure, just learn how to do the next thing. One man took his six-year-old daughter, and six is still pretty young, right? Six-year-old daughter to Knott's Berry Farm. You know what that is in Southern California? It's a little bit like Disneyland, but smaller, and it has a cowboy theme. It's a great place. So they take their six-year-old to Knott's Berry Farm, and because it's right down the street from Disney, a lot of times the lines aren't very long. And so you have a great time at Knott's Berry Farm. And the little girl got to go from one thing to another just about as fast as her little feet would carry her. She can ride this, she can ride that, and there's not really much of a line. She's having a big time for about 3 hours. After 3 hours, she steps off and she kind of rolls her eyes and says, "What's next?" I was like, you just can't do enough for these kids. We have this story we always tell about my son Luke. We went to Disney in Florida and went on the Pirates of the Caribbean ride. And, you know, of course, they route you through the gift shop after the ride's over. And he saw all the little guns, you know, that the pirates had. And he had to have a gun. And he said, "No, Luke, you can't have a gun right now. When we go home, we're going to buy you a gun. But, you know, this is like the first ride we went on that day. You can't have a gun now." And he started crying. I looked at him. He was young, right? It's not like last year. I looked at him and said, "Luke, we're at Disneyland. And you're crying. This is as good as life gets. And you're still crying. We don't have a chance here. You can't do enough for them." Well, when you're a little kid, you know, that's one thing. But you can't stay there. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a grown-up, I put away childish things. And this is all in the context of love. You can't be like that. And so we realize that as adults, and if I'm speaking even to precocious teenagers, we can't be like that, you know? You got to grow up. It's okay when you're a child, but you got to quit being like that. And children, we adults, are very reluctant to let go of that self-centeredness. I always think that's so interesting, this list. It's like children are the anti-love citizens of the world. You know, like you have the Christians and the Antichrist people. Well, you have like the lovers and the anti-lovers. And all the children are the anti-lovers. I mean, you look at this list. Love is not puffed up. And by the way, that's really interesting because that's the term that the Greek people use for bellows, you know. So love is not puffed up. Children are totally occupied with themselves, self-absorbed, self-seeking, self-centered. They're totally puffed up. The whole world revolves around them, and they think that's the way it should be. Love doesn't do that, but kids sure do. Love is not easily provoked. Oh, kids, they can really lose it. I mean, over nothing. Like, easily provoked, where did that emotion come from? You have such a strong opinion about your vegetables. I mean, you're easily provoked. Love suffers long. Kids don't. Kids are not known for their patience. They suffer not at all. They just go off on you. And it's kind. Children aren't famous for their kindness. They're famous for slapping and hitting and biting. Love does not envy. But children do. I mean, try giving just one kid a sucker. Like, ah, you know, dog pile. They envy all the time. No fair, no fair. Love does not parade itself. Oh, every child thinks that he should be the bride at every wedding, the star of every TV show, and even the corpse at every funeral. All they want to do is parade themselves. Love does not seek its own. Kids sure do. That's all they think about. Love thinks no evil. Oh, just try to stop them one time when they're trying to do something. Love bears all things. Kids bear nothing. They don't bear up with anything. Love believes all things. Kids don't even believe you when you tell them it's time to change their diaper because they're going to get a rash. They don't believe you. Kids don't believe you. They don't endure anything. Love does not rejoice in iniquity, but kids do. They'll slap somebody and laugh about it. Love rejoices in the truth. Kids don't. Like, you really need to eat these vegetables. No. That's the truth. I don't care. They don't care about the truth. Kids are like the anti-lovers in the universe. When you are a kid, that's okay. When you become a grown-up, that's not okay. And kids are reluctant to change. And sometimes we adults are reluctant to change. Jordan Peterson, we've been studying him in our Sunday school class. He's very interesting talking about child raising. We parents have to change and we have to help our kids change as well. He says, do not let your children do anything that makes you dislike them. He's talking about going through an airport And one little guy was being extraordinarily belligerent and making a scene. And all the people are walking past and, like, you know, making eyes at this kid. He says, more thoughtful parents would not have let someone they truly cared for become the object of a crowd's contempt. He says, take the case of the 3-year-old who has not learned to share. When she tries to make friends, it won't go well because of her lack of social sophistication. Children her own age will be put off by her inability to cooperate. They'll fight with her or wander off to find someone else to play with. The parents of those children will observe her awkwardness and misbehavior, and they won't invite her back to play with their kids. She will be lonely and rejected. This will produce anxiety, depression, and resentment. Parents who accept the notion that discipline is damaging to children abandon their duty to serve as agents of enculturation, and they pretend that doing so is actually good for the children. It is a deep and pernicious act of self-destruction. It's lazy, cruel, and inexcusable. You can discipline your children, or you can turn that responsibility over to the harsh, uncaring, judgmental world. Nature and society will punish in a draconian manner whatever errors of childhood behavior remain uncorrected. And if you're not thinking discipline through, then you're not acting responsibly as a parent. You're leaving the dirty work to someone else who will be much dirtier when they do it. So it's okay for kids to do what they do, but we adults can't just let them stay that way. We have to raise the kids. If they don't learn to share, if they don't learn to cooperate, if they don't learn to be nice, then socially they're going to be isolated, ostracized, and then you get a whole raft of psychological problems. You can't let that happen. As Jordan Peterson says, parents who truly care about their children aren't going to allow those children to become objects of a crowd's scorn. And so, yes, when I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought as a child. I understood as a child. But when I became a grown-up, I had to put away all those things. And mothers are doing a wonderful job today teaching their children to put those things away. And it falls on you to continue doing a very, very hard job. And it doesn't end just because your kids are teenagers. You have to stay with it. Keep doing this job because it's extraordinarily important to the child, to society, to the Lord's work. Henrietta Mears, whom I idolize, was raised by a very fine mother. And when Henrietta Mears had her biography done, her biographer said, if Henrietta returned home from a party complaining that it was dull and uneventful, her mother would gently ask her what she had done to make it interesting. She would say, wasn't there some game you could have suggested? Even though it wasn't your party, you should have felt an obligation to help others have a good time. Or if Henrietta complained about an uninspiring church meeting, her mother would say, but did you give a testimony, Henrietta? Did you offer to help plan the meeting? So you see, when you're a 6-month-old baby, of course you're going to reach for the googly-eyed character who helps you get up the hill. You're self-absorbed. It's what you do. But you can't stay there. And mothers are trying to help the children grow out of that, become grown-ups. And we parents are trying to help ourselves do that because sometimes we are always looking for the help and not the opportunity to love. And so we all have some work to do here. And what we find then is stages and phases. It's okay at a certain age to do a particular thing, but it's not okay at another age. Stages and phases. The apostle says, when I was a child, this is what I did. When I became a grown-up, I changed. Here it is again in 1 Corinthians 13:11. When I became a grown-up, I put away childish things. What a great idea. As you grow, you're going to realize that love is everything. The punchline in all this, as you see in the fine print at the bottom of this verse slide, now abides faith, hope, love, these three, and the greatest of these three is love. When everything in this world, as Peter describes it, melts away with fervent heat. The whole world is blown into ashes so the Lord can recreate it into its Edenic paradise again. When that happens, nothing is going to remain. Now abides faith, hope, and love. The house you built, gone. The mountains that you love, gone. Everything you work for in life is going to be blown into ashes. But what will still stick around when all of that is an ash heap is faith, hope, and love. Have you believed God? Faith. Hope. Did you trust Him when He said He was going to do right by you in the future, that your story would have a happy ending? That's hope, the happy ending. Faith, hope, and love. When the whole world is ashes, you'll still have that. Faith, hope, and love. And Paul says, of these three, and there are only three, of these three, the greatest is love. That's what's really going to matter forever and ever and ever. And so that's what we're doing here. We are learning that all of the things that I invested in my life don't really amount to anything except as they were related to love. My whole life is nothing more than a context for love. And what's so interesting here is in our text, 1 Corinthians 13, how Paul breaks this down, because we get it wrong, and this is so good. And in, again, in the context of those ornery Christians saying, I'm better than you, and I don't particularly need you, and if you cross me, I'll take you to court. He says, listen, though I speak with the tongues of men, even of angels, and I have no love, I'm like a noisy brass gong. In other words, would you like somebody to take a garbage can lid and just start beating it with a drumstick? How long would you like to endure that? Does that sound pretty good to you? He said, if I can speak in languages I've never studied, what do you want to hear? You want to hear Chinese, Mandarin, Cantonese? I'll do either one, whatever you want. What do you want to hear? You want to hear Italian? You want to hear German? What do you want to hear? Swahili? Whatever you want to hear, I'll speak that. If I could speak with all the languages of people, as a matter of fact, if I could speak an angel language, and we don't even know what an angel language is, because anytime we see angels in Scripture, they're speaking human languages. So I don't even know what that is. But even if there was an angel language and I could speak that, and I didn't particularly love, I'd be like this guy beating on a garbage can lid with a drumstick. How would you like that? What he's saying is, if I don't love people, it doesn't really matter what I can do, what skills I have. I have become an annoyance. Imagine going through life knowing that you're just an annoyance. And he says in verse 2, and though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, like I'm really, really smart. Like you don't understand. I'm way smarter than anybody else. I understand all mysteries. Oh, you don't understand it? I do. I understand all mysteries. Oh, you don't know? Well, I do. I mean, I'm really, really smart. I mean, wouldn't you like to be really, really smart? And here's the punchline. And if I'm that smart, and even if I have faith to move mountains, would you think that'd be pretty great? You know, the error that we hear in Christian circles sometimes is that you have to be careful what you say, because if you say it will happen, like mountain be removed, it goes in the ocean. So now I can't say, I think that I have cancer, because it'll happen. Mountain be removed. I have cancer. It happens. That's not what this is about. But what if it could be? Mountain be removed. Wouldn't it be great? So even if I had faith so that I could move mountains and I basically know everything, you know what I am then? The text? Nothing. Like, wow. It's a little harsh. Nothing? And then lastly, and what if, and who would ever do this? What if I bestow all my goods to feed the poor and give my body to be burned? But I don't love people. What am I then? Well, it profits me nothing. You think, well, why would anybody give all this stuff away if he doesn't love them? To show off. So if I do all of that, you realize what we have then? If I don't love people, I'm an annoyance, I'm nothing, and I'm profited nothing. Like, wow, sounds like love's pretty important. And that's what's going on here, that these poor Christians have forgotten that everything they do in life, you know, I have skills, baby. I mean, I have serious skills. You see what I can do. I could do lots of great stuff. Yeah, drumstick on the garbage can lid. We don't care about that. Oh, but I'm smart. I mean, I'm really, really smart. But I don't particularly love people. Well, then you're nothing. I sacrifice. I mean, big sacrifices. Like even I'm dying over here. Yeah, it profits you nothing. So you mean everything I do tomorrow when I wake up in the morning and throughout my day, everything I do basically counts for nothing unless it's done in the context of love? That's exactly what this text is saying. Now, you don't expect a six-month-old baby who's just trying to get up the hill to know any of that. He's not going to know that. The question is, do you know it? Have you come to grips with it? And hopefully the answer is, I'm beginning to come to grips with it, though it's hard. But that's the whole game. It's all about love. Stacy Eldridge, in her book Captivating, which touched a lot of Christian female hearts, she says, sometime before the sorrows of life did their best to kill it in us, most young women wanted to be part of something grand, something important. Now, you're looking at this text in 1 Corinthians 13. If you wanted to be part of something grand, something important, what does this text of Scripture tell you? If you wanted to really do something that would abide, like when the whole universe is blown into ashes, then what would you want to do? The answer is, you'd want to love people. You'd want to build people. And that's what mothers are so good at. From the time those little guys come into this world, the mothers start to build people. And you know what's so great about that? That is what's going to matter when the whole world is ashes and the Lord rebuilds another Eden. You're going to be so glad that you are building people. And you have to be so careful not to let these other things distract you from that, because that's just the whole game. So Stacy Eldridge says, we were little girls and we wanted to do something that really mattered. And it's just such a shame that so few people say, well, what really matters then is that you've loved people. And you don't have to be a mother to do that, right? This is a text for me. I'm not much of a mother, right? This is a text for me. It's a text for every single person in the world. You want to build people. Build boys and girls. And then when they get to be big boys and girls, build them some more. And when they become adults, build them some more. Build people with love. Because nothing matters. When the whole world is gone into ash, that's what's going to matter. Have we built boys and girls? Have we built young adults? Have we built older adults? Have we loved people? It's so easy to get it wrong. One lady who obviously remains anonymous because of her shame says, during a fun-filled weekend, my 5-year-old daughter said the words that still haunt me. 5 years old, right? You've ruined my life. Why did you leave Daddy? I want you to be together again. Her tears mingled with my own until I didn't know where one trail started and the other ended. I had split up with her father 3 years earlier. Our setup is unusual in that Molly lives with her father and spends every other weekend with me. Normally, a child gets to stay with her mother. It will be my eternal regret that that's not the case for us. When I gave birth to Molly, I could never have imagined how things would turn out. I remember feeling cushioned by so much love and happiness. And yet, within 4 short years, I had been relegated from omnipresent devoted mother to a mere walk-on part in Molly's life. It was me who ended our 4-year marriage. It's another woman, my ex's new wife, who is there when my daughter is upset, holds her when she cries, takes her to school, and picks her up after school. The pain of that knowledge twists in me like a knife. I am on the periphery of her life like a favorite aunt. With hindsight, if I knew the emotional consequences on our family, especially my daughter, that knowledge may have paralyzed me from taking the action I did when I broke up our family. In some ways, whatever it takes. You know, this is not supposed to be a guilt trip or an ego trip for those who have great marriages or whatever. Whatever it takes, you have to love people. You have to build people. You say, yeah, well, that triangle guy at the top of the hill keeps pushing me down. When you were a baby, it was okay to reject that triangle guy at the top of the hill. but you can't reject them anymore. That's what it means to grow up, to put away childish things. You're going to suffer long and still be kind. You're not going to parade yourself. You're going to believe the best in people. You're not going to be the one who demands his own preference. That's what it means. You can't give up on building people with love just because the triangle guy is pushing you down the hill. It happens in ways large and small. This is still a large way. Once again, just remove all the politics from this, right? I'm just telling you a story. In some ways, you just have to draw your own conclusion. But this is the story. I don't know if this is from a Christian woman or not. If I had a second chance, I would have quit my job when my children were born. I would not have made so many excuses to say I have to work, because they were mostly lies. I would have told my husband and my friends and my mother-in-law that I would raise my children. But I was too obsessed with my life and how I thought I was supposed to live it. I wish I could change the past. I would say no to spending money on anything but the essentials so I could stay home. Now my children have no time for me. Now it's too late. They have their own lives. And as my ex and I worked all the time, our children learned to get comfort elsewhere. We all are making decisions. Now, what if you did want to come to the place where, when the whole universe was reduced to ash, you wanted something that's going to abide? Depending on your context, maybe what you're doing for work will abide. In some way, that's God's work, right? You're providing for your family. But are you sure it's God's best work for you? Have you even been brave enough to ask Him? Is that the best thing? Because what you really want to do is make sure that you are propagating faith, hope, and love. And especially of these three, love. Because that's the greatest of all, is your daily routine affecting love in the lives of the people around you. Little things. Only 33% of families eat meals together on a regular basis. How hard is it, after all, to have meals together? Can you do that? Catherine Snow at Harvard's Graduate School indicated that mealtime conversations in young children build vocabulary better than reading to them. Everybody knows it's good to read to children. Eating with them is better than that. University of Illinois study indicated the best achievement test takers were children who spent large amounts of time eating family meals together with their parents. Reader's Digest survey indicated that family meals together was a stronger predictor of academic success than just living with two parents. The National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University had a survey that indicated teens who ate with their families five times a week were more likely to get A's in school, to be emotionally stable, to work hard at school, and have positive friendships. Those who did not eat with their parents on a regular basis were more likely to smoke tobacco and pot, drink alcohol, fight, feel depressed, contemplate suicide, and be promiscuous. I mean, we could do that, right? We could eat family meals together. We could do that. It's just, has it become your priority? Are you building boys and girls? Are you building young adults? Are you building older adults? Is it what you do? Is it what you crave to do? Is it what you have settled on as your life's ambition? Because the greatest of these is always going to be love. And mothers are so great at that. And mothers who have done that, thank you for that. God bless you for that. How wonderful you are. But it's not just a mother's thing, right? Some of you females are not mothers, and that's fine. You don't have to be a mother. And this is still the message for you. And I'm not a mother, and I think this is still a message for me. All right, so Mother's Day has to have a traditional element, and we talked about World War II, and now we have to do our information please story. I love this story, and I refer to it often, so just think of it as a tradition that we do together, okay? Many years ago, a little boy younger than 9 years old is one of the first families in his neighborhood to get a telephone, living in the area near Seattle, Washington. In those days, parents didn't hover quite as much as they do now. And so this little guy was working at the workbench in the basement while his mom was visiting the neighbor, and he smacked his finger with the hammer. So he didn't know what else to do. Mom was at the neighbor's. He went over to the new telephone, and he picked it up and dialed the operator and said, "Information, please." And the information lady came on the other end of the line. And now they had a sympathetic ear. He cried out in his misery. And he said, "I hit my finger with a hammer." The information please lady said, "Is your mommy home?" "No, she's next door at the neighbor's." Said, "Do you have an ice box?" "Yes." "Do you think you could chip a piece of ice off the block of ice in the ice box?" "Yes." "Well, you go do that and then put that on your finger and that will help you." And that's what he did. He said, "Well, after that, I called information please for everything." This magical voice at the other end of the line just became my friend. And so he said, "I asked her for help with my geography and she told me where Philadelphia was, which is a long ways from Seattle, right? She helped me with my math. She told me the pet chipmunk that I caught at the park just the day before would eat fruits and nuts. And then there was a time when Petey, our pet canary, died. I called information, please, and told her the sad story. She listened, and then she said, 'Well, Paul, always remember that there are other worlds to sing in.' And somehow, I felt better. Another day, I was on the telephone, and I said, 'How do you spell fix?' And she told me. And all this took place in a small town in the Pacific Northwest. When I was 9 years old, we moved across the country to Boston. As I grew into my teens, the memories of those childhood conversations never really left me. And so he's 10 years old, 11, 12, 13, 14. And now it's time for him to go to college. And he's been thinking about this information, please, lady, for a long time. His sister still lives in Seattle. He's going to college, and he's going to stop off and Seattle at the airport, so he calls his sister and talks with her for a little while. He still has layover time. It occurs to him that he might just like to see if the information please lady is still there. So he calls up his hometown operator, says, "Information please." And miraculously, Paul says, "I heard the small, clear voice I knew so well. Information." I hadn't planned this, but I heard myself asking, "Could you please tell me how to spell fix?" And there was a long pause. Then came the soft-spoken answer. "Well, I guess your finger must have healed by now." I laughed. "So it's really you. I wonder if you have any idea how much you meant to me during that time. I wonder," she said, "if you know how much your calls meant to me. I never had any children. And I used to look forward to your calls." I told her how often I thought of her over the years. And I asked if I could call her again when I came back this way to visit my sister. She said, "Please do. Just ask for Sally. I'm Sally." So 3 months later, I was back in Seattle. A different voice answered information, and I asked for Sally. "Are you a friend?" she asked. "Yes, a very old friend," I answered. "Well, I'm sorry to have to tell you this. Sally's been working part-time the last few years because she was sick, and she died 5 weeks ago." Before I could hang up, she said, "Wait a minute, is your name Paul?" "Yes." "Well, Sally left a message for you. She wrote it down in case you called. Let me read it to you." The note says, "Tell him I still say there are other worlds to sing in. He'll know what I mean. When this world is gone, 3 things are going to matter to you: faith, hope, and love. And of those 3, which are utterly important, the greatest is love. You want to build children, boys and girls, and you want to build young adults with love, and you want to build older folks with love, and that's all you're ever going to really care about. It's okay when you're a child to speak like a child and understand it as a child and think like a child. But at some point, we have to put away these things and we have to be grown-ups and we have to teach others to do the same. And that is why we love mothers on Mother's Day. That's why we love all people who have taken up the mantle of Jesus to love the world. I'd like you to bow your heads and close your eyes. If you've never yet trusted Jesus as your Savior, can I address you on this Mother's Day for just a moment? The reason this whole love thing is so important to us in this service today, not just because of mother's love, but because of God's love. And He is the exemplar. He's the one who shows us how to do this. You've been so loved. And now the gospel is that God, who so loved the world, gave His only begotten Son. And if you believe on Him, you don't ever have to perish. Sally in Information Please was right about that. There is another world to sing in, you know. You have to plan on that world. And if you haven't been planning on that world, that's what you need to do now. The gospel is that Jesus will save you. Whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. You want a Savior? You got Him. You want a rescuer? You have it. You just have to call on Him because you believe, because you want Him in your life. I'd like to give you a moment of silence to do that. If you haven't already done that, you can call on the Lord in the privacy of your own thoughts right now for His everlasting forgiveness and everlasting home with Him in heaven. And I hope you'll do that in the quietness of this moment.